For years, we've been told that everything we fund and support is in the name of our shared democratic values. Everything from our Ukraine policy to digital censorship is billed as a defense of democracy. But when we see European courts canceling elections and senior officials threatening to cancel others, we ought to ask whether we're holding ourselves to an appropriately high standard. And I say ourselves because I fundamentally believe that we are on the same team. We must do more than talk about democratic values. We must live them.
All right, that was the Vice President J.D. Vance at the Munich conference. Remember, we played the entire speech because it was so powerful. But that little segment, he's calling out European interests, especially the European Union, but others too, for canceling elections, reaching out, stopping people that they don't want to vote. We talked about Romania in the context of that. Calin Georgescu arrested. Now he cannot run, even though he had won an election, and they arrested him and disqualified him. We've had the same thing, same pattern happen in many countries. We, of course, had that the attempt on that in our country. It's very effective if you accuse your the person you don't like, who the people like, of some crime, and then put them in jail or even kill them. It's very handy to get them out of the way. And so this is a pattern that we see. And the latest incident has just broken out in the beautiful country of France. And so we're going to talk about that today and an update on a few of the other countries, because Paul has just returned from, Paul Coyer is our guest today. He's just returned from Spain. So there's interesting things happening in Spain as well. So I hope you'll stay tuned. Well, new estimates show that more than 1 million babies were killed by abortion in 2023. It's the highest amount of abortions since 2012. Can you believe that? And the reason for that is the abortion pill. It's exploded. It's now available at local pharmacies. It's available through the mail. And a woman's bathroom has become the scene of the crime where she tragically expels her child. It's tragic for the baby, but it's tragic for the woman. And sometimes women actually bring their aborted babies into preborn clinics begging for help, but it's too late. But the thing about preborn is that they actually have a pill that can counter that abortion pill. And so if you catch it early enough, if you change your mind, you can go to those clinics and they can give you the pill and save the baby and stop you from making this horrible decision. Preborn is in the business, of course, of doing lots of things to save lives. They provide ultrasounds to women to try to stop this before they take the pill, before they try to make a decision. Let them see their baby, and hopefully, in fact, most of them do change their minds when they see the baby in their womb. And you've been very generous to make that happen. Those big stats are not for nothing. They're for people like you who said, I want to do something. I can do that. It's $28 for one ultrasound, at least to give an ultrasound to one woman. And so if you can give $28 or any multiple of that, or any really amount that you have to give, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, this is Sandy Rios 24/7. And if you'd like to call us, you can do that at 662-821-2040. You can reach us at any social media platform that you like. Just pick your favorite, Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, True Social, and YouTube. There are some videos on YouTube of things that I've done. You might enjoy that. Telegram also. It goes on and on. Also, you can listen to the show on any podcast platform that you prefer. Home base, though, for us is AFR.net. You can certainly listen there at any time. You can also go to sandyrios.com. That's my website, and listen pretty easily. So, we try to bring you the latest and just some in-depth interviews that you might not hear other places. All of these years I've been doing radio means that I know a lot of people, and it's a real privilege and a pleasure. I will miss when I can't do this again. And that's so I bring these friends to your attention and bring them to the mic and help them provide a way for them to educate you as they have educated me through the years. And today actually is an example of that. Paul Coyer has been a friend for years. He's an expert on international relations. He just came back from Spain, and he has stories to tell us about what's happening in Europe and other places around the globe on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something. All right, that's, I just let it re-air, Adam. That's the national anthem from France. And it's led, you can't see it, but it's led by Marie Le Pen and a group of protesters, because Marie Le Pen has just been declared, found guilty, according to the EU courts, of extortion of some sort and sentenced to 4 years in prison. She has been the favored conservative leader in France for many years. She's tried to win, I think, three times, and each time she runs, she gets more of the percentage. I think the last time was 37%. And now the upcoming election, they suspect she might, it's 2 years away, but she might have won, but now they've taken care of that because they're going to put her in jail, prison, whatever it is, and they have banned her from running for 5 years. That's just an example of what's been happening around the globe. We've talked about Romania. We talked about Canada. We've talked about all kinds of places where this is happening, and no one has insight into this better than my next guest. Paul Coyer, Dr. Paul Coyer, is an expert on foreign policy and national security. His credentials are amazing. I'm not even going to read all of them to you, but he is a research professor at the Institute of World Politics. But what sets Paul apart is he not only is an expert on these things, but he goes to these countries. He's traveling constantly. He speaks several languages. He gets involved. He tries to help. And the last thing I will say for my audience, Paul is a Christian. Probably, I'm guessing, one of the few that does what he does. Is that true, Paul? Do you see a lot of guys on the road who are in your position?
In my position, meaning people of faith, of any faith, much less the Christian faith, that apply that to their analysis of global affairs?
Well, yeah, kind of like that. Like more as active as you are in global affairs, and also your foot in both camps. You're not just doing specifically labeled Christian work. You are involved in the politics of the areas. Anybody else doing that?
Very, very few that I've seen, no. I mean, I have several friends that are devout Christian believers that have deep involvement in foreign affairs, or some I won't name here. I mean, there are a few, yeah, but it's just none of us want a really particularly high profile. None of us seek out media except for, you know, friendly media like yourself. So you're not going to see us as talking heads on Fox or CNN or anything like that for a number of reasons, one of which is we feel like we're more effective if we kind of fly under the radar. Your audience is a completely different story because, you know, you tend to reach people that would be very like-minded, that would see the world from a similar perspective, and so that's a different story. But there are a few out there to answer your question. They're just not well-known.
Yeah. So, Paul, to that point, you just returned from Italy. We corresponded while you were there.
Spain.
Only there for what? Spain.
Yeah.
Spain. Sorry about that.
It's always a different country, so it's easy to get confused.
Well, okay. So Spain, and you were there, I think, for 4 days. And so I would tell you right up front, I'm confused. I've been reading about lots of protests there for different reasons, at least two major ones. What were you doing there? What's the current issue that's got everyone so stirred in Spain?
Yeah, well, right now Spain has socialist leadership, and since Francisco Franco died in 1975, Spain has generally alternated between center-right party called Partido Popular, or the People's Party. That name would cause many Americans to think it's a left-leaning party. It is not. It's a conservative party. One prime minister that was, you know, fairly prominent that they may remember from that party was José María Aznar, who was back in 1996 to 2004, I believe. Very well-respected guy. And then they usually go back and forth between socialist prime ministers and Partido Popular, conservative prime ministers. So right now, the socialists are in power. Partido Popular is in the minority. There has been an upstart Spanish conservative party called Vox, V-O-X, which has appeal. It doesn't have a broad enough appeal to win a general election. Partido Popular is the mainstream conservative party that has the appeal to win the general election. But they really, the two conservative parties really need to work together. And that's been a bit difficult to do for various reasons, having to do with somewhat different constituencies on the part of the two. But I was there and participated in several hours of a conference in Madrid on Wednesday evening. That was about a number of issues, including elite corruption, which is endemic in Madrid, just like it is in the rest of the EU. Corruption between business interests and political interests, which always, you know, go hand in hand. It had to do with economic organization, with political theory, with a bunch of related topics, all from a conservative point of view. And then I had a number of meetings throughout the few days I was there with people on the conservative side, mostly from Partido Popular, one or two with Vox. And people that were not just involved in politics, although many of them were, but also people that were involved in shaping a healthier culture in Spain. So a couple of them, for example, have a family foundation that emphasizes the importance of the family unit to personal meaning and fulfillment and human flourishing in Spanish culture. They do an amazing job at it, too. They don't come across as the stereotype on the part of the left is anyone that advocates for this sort of thing is going to be a right-wing Christian theocracy endorsing fanatic. Definitely not the case. These guys were, and women, were people who had come from very dysfunctional backgrounds, you know, themselves, and they purposely made a focus of their outreach. One of the focuses of the outreach in Spain, young people who were LGBT, for example, and the messaging is that a cohesive core family and traditional family unit is most important for people who feel on the fringes of society because it gives you a sense of belonging that will not just take advantage of you in various ways. Anyway, the bottom line is I met with a lot of really interesting people doing good work on the art side and publishing in culture, in family, and in politics, and in economics and business. Very worthwhile 4 days, whirlwind 4 days, but very worthwhile. A lot of good things going on in Spain. It's always encouraging to see the good actors doing so many good things in each of these countries.
Well, politically, do you think the parties that you mentioned, the two conservative parties, the Vox and the new one, if they did combine, do you think they could actually prevail in an election in Spain?
Oh, if they did, yes. The question is if they could, and I think it's extremely unlikely that it will combine. Vox is the new one. That's the more conservative of the two. It focuses more on, well, it does focus on cultural issues, but immigration is their big thing. They're very similar to Marine Le Pen's party in France, in that area, and very similar to Reform UK, Nigel Farage's in the UK in the same way. And so their constituency is a lot of blue-collar workers, much as Trump's is here, people very concerned about unvetted, massive immigration, and some cultural issues. Whereas Partido Popular, you know, has people concerned about those issues, but they are the more mainstream, long-term conservative party that I mentioned, Partido Popular, has a broader constituency. So the only party of those two that could win a general election is Partido Popular, but they are unlikely to win an outright majority of parliamentary seats. So they would really need to align themselves with Vox in a coalition government. That could happen. But it's just become, it's been difficult. Anytime you work in anywhere in Europe with trying to put different coalitions together, which on paper should be allies, there are always personality issues or other political considerations that can so easily torpedo it. And right now there's been a real issue in Spain between those two parties. So Vox, for example, the new party, just withdrew from, I think, four, five, or six different governorships of regions and mayor city governments withdrew from coalitions with their political conservative allies, Partido Popular, for various reasons. It's just tough to get that alliance together, but they do need to come together if they're going to win, yes.
Well, so now I really am curious about this, Paul, because Spain is part of the EU, and I don't recall hearing much about the open border issue and the influx of young Muslim men as we did in Germany and France and all these other countries, because Spain has more of a history with Islam. It seems like there was already some influence there. So how do you see that? Did that happen to Spain as well, and we just didn't hear about it?
It, to a degree, yes. It did happen to a lesser degree, you are correct, than we saw, for example, in Belgium, in Germany, and in some other places. But it did happen in Spain, and part of the reason why it's easy to happen in Spain is because of proximity. It's such a short distance from Morocco over to the Spanish mainland. And, you know, there are immigrants that try to make that on boats and come in other ways as well. So the Spanish have had an influx. It has not been as great as in Germany and some of these other places. I mean, Angela Merkel has really opened the floodgates in Germany. But the socialists in Spain have really opened up the doors as well. And so it is a problem. It just may not be as big a problem statistically as it is in Germany, has been in Sweden and some of these other places. But Spain has felt it, and it is an issue. And that's one of the issues driving Vox's popularity in the areas where Vox is popular.
Does Spain still have a monarchy? Do they still have a king and the royal families? Yeah, you know, I was going to something funny, an aside, not related, and I won't take much time, but I happen to become friends with a Countess de Romanones. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but she was a spy with the precursor to the CIA during World War II, and she was recommended to me for an interview.
Yeah, she's well known.
Well, she became an amazing friend, and she's very, very bright, even into her 90s, Paul. And she married a Spanish count there.
She's not alive still, is she?
And she died, no, a few years ago. I wish she had been.
I really,
yeah, so she, but she has sons there.
What an extraordinary privilege to get to know her, huh?
Yeah. She has sons there. She has sons because she married the count, of course, of Romanones, and her sons are there.
I would
love
to meet them the next time I'm over there, if you're in contact. I would love. They sound like amazing guys.
Yeah, I'd like to try that. But anyway, that was very. She was. It's just amazing her story. She was recruited off the street. She was a beautiful woman, and she ended up being dropped off in Spain from a plane, you know, to do her first mission. So anyway, that's the sidebar story. But all right, so what's the EU's role in any of this in Spain? I mean, do they have a role in this? Or is this strictly an internal Spanish consideration?
Well, I really don't have a lot of insight to give on what the dynamic has been between the current Spanish socialist government and the EU.
Okay.
I'm sure that they see eye to eye. I mean, they're socialists in Spain. So they are probably very much in sync with Ursula von der Leyen and other EU and EC leaders on the immigration issue. So there's not going to be probably any daylight there. But whether or not the EU really influences or even needs to Madrid's policy on this, I kind of doubt it because, you know, the current government is very pro fairly unvetted immigration. In the rest of Europe, of course, it's a different story, especially when you see, you know, Hungary, obviously we all know about that. We all know about Poland as well, has set a very firm line on you know, immigration. Not saying zero immigration, but saying we don't want the massive waves that our neighbor Germany has seen with all the dysfunction that arises from that. France, of course, very, very infamously, we've seen all the major issues there, the horrific attacks, the beheading of priests, all the other things in the last few years. You know, the thing is the EU tends to be aligned with the elites from these countries that share their worldview. That tends to be a left-leaning worldview, but even more than a right or left issue, I think it's an issue of just corruption. They want to continue to bolster their own power. And as you know, a lot of these EU leaders are not at all elected. They're elected within some elite body within the EU or the EC, but they're not elected by the European people. And so that, by definition, is, in my view, anti-democratic, which is the point that J.D. Vance was trying to make in Munich. Yeah, to answer your question on Madrid, I really don't know what influence the EU may play. It does play one throughout the rest of the continent, and they do. The EU really does beat anyone over the head politically with what they seem to be see as moral shaming as well as political and economic pressure to go along with what the EU wants on any of these social issues, from immigration to censorship, which is a really, really yes. big one that I'm sure we'll discuss in a minute.
Exactly. So speaking of France, I started out with that clip of Marie Le Pen and her followers singing the anthem for the French. And of course, we have to say the French Revolution was nothing like ours. It was a secular revolution, I would say, by contrast, and it was very violent and not necessarily one we would want to emulate, we should suggest that. But that song came out of that revolution, and it brings the revolutionary spirit, which is why they were singing it. So tell us about what's going on there, Paul, the inside, as best you can, as much as you can tell me or know.
Yeah, I just tell you what you probably already know yourself, which is that it's pretty clear that the elites in the EU and in France are following the same exact playbook. The bottom line is I don't know all the intricacies of the legal charges against Marine Le Pen. I know what you know and what anyone with common sense knows reading the news and the media on that, which is that it looks like it is much ado about nothing. It looks like, and there may be something there, I doubt it, because it looks very much like it's just plain lawfare, much as we saw against President Trump for the previous 4 years, much as we've seen in so many other cases from Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, throughout the EU.
Yeah.
And so I would doubt there's anything there. And even if there is some minor infraction there, I can guarantee you that the mainstream, i.e. left-leaning elites throughout the EU, do a million times worse than this all the time and don't even get a slap on the wrist. So there's the issue of, you know, blatant hypocrisy and double standards. So this is clearly lawfare and political persecution. Even if she did do anything minor that was a technical legal infraction, it's nothing compared to what Macron and what Sarkozy and what others have done in the past.
Yeah.
And it's clear that it's going to result in a backlash from the part of the French people. I mean, we've seen this in Romania as well, with Calin Georgescu being taken out of the presidential race there first in December, and then when he submitted paperwork again about a month ago for the second the reiteration of the rescheduled presidential race in Romania, he was told he couldn't apply and couldn't run. And the same thing is happening in Romania and in France now, meaning that the anger on the part of the grassroots French and Romanian peoples, respectively, against their elites is going to grow so exponentially that even if there were anything, I mean, I read interviews with people in France and talked to people in Romania and France that have said some of us completely oppose Calin Georgescu in Romania, for example, or Marine Le Pen in France, but that's irrelevant, because it's pretty clear that they're being persecuted politically, and that's wrong. And so that innate sense of justice among fair-minded citizens in France and Romania, respectively, has been so offended that even people that wouldn't normally support these candidates are beginning to get up in arms over the elites clearly wanting to run the show for their own benefit and not caring about democratic governance and the wishes of the grassroots citizens in each country.
Yeah, well, for the people that live there, it's a nightmare. And we got a taste of that. But thank God we were able to push it back. But to not have freedom of speech, to not be able to say what you want, to have your candidates destroyed before you, I mean, with President Trump, he's exhibit A of trying to destroy a candidate,
yep,
to imprison him, to try to kill him. And that's basically what
that's
we're
right.
talking about with Calin Georgescu and also now with Marine Le Pen. So, Paul, I'm curious, maybe if you have an opinion about this. You know about the tariffs and the global reset that President Trump is trying to do. And so that involves the EU and involves all the countries we're talking about here. Do you sense that this global reset could weaken the EU economically enough to let the people have a chance to... I don't know what the agreement is about the European Union, but is there a chance it could ever be revoked and these countries could withdraw like Britain did?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a large chance that the EU can disintegrate. I mean, for one thing, when you look at the fundamentals, and a lot of people have been talking about this, the EU has been a project, a political and economic project that was meant to basically allow Germany and France to run the continent. And so as much as they all talk about how they believe in multilateralism and, you know, it's touchy-feely kumbaya time, you know, the elites in Paris and Berlin don't care about that. They care about their own national power. It's kind of ironic because they always decry, quote-unquote, nationalism, but yet it's their own national interests that they are advocating most strongly by putting Germany and France at the head of the EU. They don't really care about multilateralism, which is one of the reasons why people in Central Eastern Europe, so many of them, tend to look askance at Brussels, Berlin, and Paris, because they know that the elites in those Western European capitals don't care a whit about the interests of Central and Eastern European citizens or countries. So you've got that dynamic. You've got a growing discomfort and lack of political support for the EU as a political project among normal European citizens. Then you've got the German economic model, which is imploding. That economic model has been based on among other things, cheap energy, which now is no longer available to Germany because of the Russian war in Ukraine, and because of Germany deciding even before deciding to wean itself off of Russian energy under pressure. Before that, Angela Merkel, back 20 years ago, made, in my view, some very poor decisions by deciding that it was somehow green to get rid of nuclear power, which is incredibly clean and dependable, among other things. And so Germany has really kind of slit its own throat in this way in terms of energy. That has added costs dramatically to German industry, which has made it less productive. German industry and the German economy in general has been the economic engine for the whole of the EU. And now that the German economic model is imploding for the energy reasons, for demographic reasons, there are worker shortages, especially skilled worker shortages. We all think of the famous German engineer stereotype, right?
Right.
And there are so many fewer of them now. They don't have nearly enough to go around. They just aren't German engineers like there used to be. That's a major problem. There are a lot of other major issues with the German economy, but the bottom line is that the German economic model is pretty well dead, which means that the EU economically is going to come screeching to a halt. It was already facing major structural issues for demographics issues, you know, demographics problems, for economic productivity issues, their vast social welfare system, which their demographics and their economic structures can no longer support. So the EU it's going to be difficult to see how it can survive another 10 years, I think. So do I see it as a possibility that the EU could implode? Absolutely. In fact, I see it as a likelihood.
Well, Viktor Orban, you know, has pulled or declared he's no longer going to be held to the dictates of the International Criminal Court, and that's why Netanyahu went to see him, which is really interesting, isn't it? So because the International Criminal Court has a warrant out for Netanyahu's arrest. But do you think it's like in the case of Hungary? I'm asking you things I know nothing about. Do you think Hungary is likely to, and these new European countries are likely to withdraw from the EU?
Hungary was one of the later ones to join it. So in Hungary's case, I don't see it even under Viktor Orban is withdrawing right now. I'm not sure how competent I feel to prognosticate on how the EU might implode. I'm just giving you some of the fundamentals that have held it together, one of which being the German economic model, which is now kaput, pun intended, which means that the EU is going to have a tougher time holding together just because economic productivity is no longer there. EU citizens overall can no longer sustain a consumption-led model of economic growth, for example, because of demographics, because of all the issues I just described. That's another major issue. So all I can do is say that the long-term structural issues economically and politically, in terms of lack of political support among the grassroots in Europe for the EU as a political project and other issues, they all tend to point in one direction. It looks to me like the EU cannot survive another decade or so. How it will implode, I really don't know. But I just don't see it surviving. It would be very difficult for it to survive.
You know, I just want to point out, though, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Paul, it's very sad, actually, not about the EU, but about the countries they represent who have such great histories and were founded, well, not founded, that's not true, but they had strong influence from Christianity, and you've seen that kind of stripped, kind of an enemy of the faith the EU has become.
Correct.
I remember when they forced Ireland to legalize abortion. Ireland, I think, was the last country to go down on that. They have had a sweeping effect, forcing their will upon these countries. And so now we are like, as the Canadians, the candidate right now for prime minister is saying that, America is now the enemy of Canadians because they operate under that same mindset. It's getting it's sad and it's dangerous. We are losing allies. We are becoming isolated. And I'm not sure what's going to come of that, but I guess America has really become a beacon of light to the world again, at least for this moment, and that is kind of encouraging.
Well, to a degree, that's true. I mean, you hear diametrically opposed opinions depending on which European you talk to. You'll hear some that say the narrative that we hear from the left, that the U.S. is isolating itself, that Donald Trump is a rogue actor, which we heard since 2016, of course, and that the United States is becoming anti-democratic. It seems rather obvious to observers like you and me that the opposite is the case in terms of our democratic commitments at home. I mean, we now have, for example, an administration that is not going to try to push through a Ministry of Truth at the Department of Homeland Security, which is what the Biden administration tried to do, basically a censorship regime that tried to censor all Americans' free speech, online or otherwise. You're seeing an administration that is going after unaccountable corruption, tens and hundreds of billions of dollars flowing out in corrupt deals from the executive branch to left-leaning NGOs, et cetera, et cetera. And an opening of the books so that people can actually see, the American citizens can see some transparency about what's going on and how the sausage gets made, so to speak, in Washington. And it's not pretty. And Trump is returning accountability. I know you and I see this the same way, to the government by force. How that can be decreed as anti-democratic is just a logic that I don't get. Then I talk to other people in Europe. The friends of mine that I'm talking to regularly in Romania and Poland and elsewhere are saying, for example, starting with Vance's speech in Munich, some of the people I talked to in Spain last week, for example, said, we are so glad that the vice president made that speech in Munich, because we saw that as a shot across the bow of the corrupt left-wing elites here in the EU. And we saw that as being very reminiscent of Ronald Reagan's 1987 speech at the Berlin Wall, saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It was a moral stand that was a once-in-a-generation sort of thing. And they're very grateful that Trump and Vance is taking this stand against EU censorship, cancellation of elections, et cetera, et cetera.
I guess the vacuum that really strikes me, too, is that this is an opportune time. With all of these countries struggling, all the ones we've talked about, and, when you joined me last, we spent a long time talking about Romania, and the removal of, forced removal of Calin Georgescu from running ever again. I think ever again. They arrested him. It's amazing what's happening in these countries, and they are flailing, and people are divided like they are around the globe right now. It's really a great moment for some superpower of some sort, and not America, to come in and just take power. It seems like a real vulnerable time for Europe to me, Paul, which makes me think of China. And I don't want to go too much in this, but I know you're an expert on China, too. So how do you see, when you see their vulnerability, we know who our enemies are, but who are Europeans' enemies? Who would have an eye on their treasures and their land and be motivated to take that for themselves?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody wants to take European land, and I think you probably didn't mean that literally, but I don't think even Russia does. And I think so many analysts say that Russia wants to conquer Europe, and I just think that's just not at all the case. For one thing, what would Vladimir Putin gain from sending his armies into Europe? They've had trouble enough with Ukraine.
Exactly.
He hardly wants to embroil them in further wars. It just seems illogical. And Putin, you might criticize him, as we do in the West, for a number of different things. And he is certainly not a democratic leader, and he certainly is an authoritarian dictator in many senses, but he's not stupid. And he's certainly not going to he's not going to invade anybody else, I don't believe. So I don't think anybody, even Vladimir Putin, wants to take their land, I don't think. I think that what China wants in its case is China wants a commercial empire that then gives that where their growing economic strength leads them gradually over time to take over political and normative, meaning shaping the shaping of values that shape international society and the international sphere. That's they want that to all come to Beijing. So Beijing has control over shaping those norms and values that shape the world. And they want to do that partly because their prism that they see the world through, the Chinese Communist Party's prism, is they want to make sure that they keep their top on, at the monopoly, their monopoly on power in Beijing. And so the way that the Chinese, the People's Republic of China, interacts with the rest of the world and its position in the global power hierarchy is intricately and completely related to the CCP's ability to maintain their monopoly on power at home. So if China, for example, continues to rise, and they're facing a lot of structural challenges as well, a lot of political, a lot of economic, a lot of and demographic, clearly, challenges. But if they can find, by some miracle, to find a way through all these major hurdles they're facing and continue to rise in the global stage, then that really is a good thing for the Chinese Communist Party, because that enables them to be able to maintain their grip on power at home. Because the Chinese people, partly the thinking goes this way, the Chinese people will see the CCP as delivering on their promise to make China great again, to borrow a phrase, to make China, to bring it back to, I mean, all Chinese people feel this way. And I think it's important to point this out as well. It's not just the Chinese Communist Party that feels this way. All Chinese people feel that China has been pushed out of its quote-unquote rightful spot atop the world. And they feel that way because of a Chinese history, which is indeed rich in scientific and technological innovation and cultural achievement and refinement. There was a reason why the Chinese thought of the rest of the world as barbarians, because quite frankly, they were very refined culturally. And that's, I mean, I did my PhD on China, as you know, and lived there. So I had great respect for their culture and their history. But that has made them blind as a people to their own failings. And it's interesting that about a little over 100 years ago, there was a movement that was a literary movement that Mao Zedong actually was a young person in the middle of, where the Chinese were trying to decide with the implosion of the Qing Empire in 1911 and 12, and the years prior to and immediately after that, the Chinese themselves were debating what is the reason for China's great fall from the apex of human civilization and economic and political power on the global stage to now where everyone can walk all over us, from the primarily the Japanese at that time, but others as well. And there was a big debate. Mao Zedong came on the side that leaned to the Marxist side of that debate, which was that it was because the predatory Western and Japanese powers and capitalism was, you know, taking advantage of China and wanted to take it over for its own, you know, its own economic and political and strategic interests. And of course, there was actually some truth to that, especially in the case of the Japanese. Others on the Chinese side were debating and saying it was really our own fault. And actually, in my view, they were more correct. They said the reason why we have fallen from the apex of power around the world is because, number one, we were incredibly arrogant and we didn't want to learn from anybody else. So the West technologically outstripped us. We rested on our laurels a millennia past of technological achievements and knowledge, and we were outstripped technologically and military strength and every other way, and it's our own fault. So if we want to strengthen ourselves, we need to really learn from others while maintaining the Chinese essence of what we bring into us. That debate, I think, needs to be had again, because right now, the Chinese people overall feel that China has been treated poorly for nearly 200 years now, and they feel it's China's rightful spot to, you know, to rise to the apex of geopolitical power. The Chinese Communist Party can deliver that, then they will have a way to save themselves, because right now they're not seen as all that legitimate at home. But this would really help them to achieve that. But getting back to the relationship with Europe that you asked about, that's a whole part of that. China wants to have to be the dominant economic, trade, and geopolitical actor in Europe. And so on the negative side, we might, many of us might support some of the things Trump is doing vis-a-vis the Europeans. But, you know, the European elites in Brussels, which in my view are very, very corrupt, be that as it may, the geopolitical reality is the door is open now for China. And that's not a good thing. And yes. I'm hearing that from a lot of my friends, and that's a real concern, because China is now trying to portray itself, ironically, given the fact that they've, from within the WTO, decimated, used the rules of world trade against us and really took it over and hollowed it out. Nevertheless, now they are pretending that in the wake of allegedly Donald Trump, you know, destroying free trade, that the Chinese are its champion, and you can trust Beijing, and Beijing will take over that flag. So there's a real danger there.
That makes a lot of sense, Paul, and I love all that. You know, I've been to China several times, also not in the same way you were. Mine was more interviews of people that were persecuted, but still you have a feel for the country, and so that's really fascinating what you just shared. But that kind of answers my question, because I'm with you about, I don't think Putin once has an interest either. He's stretched. Their whole economy is in trouble too. And so they don't want to go into Europe. Yep. But I think my question was more based on conversations I've had with Gordon Chang. Gordon has indicated he believes that China actually does want the land here. They want to displace Americans. That's Gordon's thought about this. And take what we have. And I think they were in a position and infiltrating and, you know, making plans to do that. But I wondered if they were thinking the same thing in Europe, but you've answered that question. And it makes a lot of sense that they want to control, like they're trying to control the globe, whether it's South America or Africa, going in and building, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative. So it makes perfect sense that they want to do that in Europe.
Exactly. No, they're the ultimate neo-imperialist power, meaning they want to control the flow of all resources, natural resources, critical minerals, energy resources, food production, which is crucial for a country of well over a billion people, especially in a country, China, where the arable land has been shrinking dramatically every year, and the water table underneath the North China Plain has been insufficient to support food production forever, for decades. And so they need food production, they need critical minerals, rare earths. We all know about China's dominance of that. They need energy. They need so many other things, and they need that all to flow to China. And, of course, that raises the issue of control of the sea lanes of supply, especially through the Malacca Straits, through the Indo-Pacific, which raises the role of the U.S. Navy and why that is so critically important and why China sees us as a barrier to their ability to be self-sufficient in these areas. Not self-sufficient in the sense that they get all their energy and critical minerals and other needs domestically. They just can't do that. They don't have those resources. But self-sufficient in the sense that they at least control the sea lanes of supply to China, through which the majority of their energy and critical minerals and food imports flow. And that's a major issue for them. And so that is one of the major things that's driving the confrontation in the naval sphere, in the military sphere, but primarily Navy, in the Indo-Pacific right now, is the Chinese desire, which is completely logical from Beijing's point of view, to want to have secure lines of supply that they control that don't depend on the U.S. Navy and American allies potentially interdicting in times of conflict.
Yeah. And then, of course, we'll have to do another show on this. That reminds me of Greenland. It reminds me of the Iceland, the battle over Iceland. North, the North Pole, and all of those channels. It's just fascinating to me. And, Paul, it's really great to get your perspective. That brings us back to Europe. I guess the one last question I have for you, do you see, because you and I are both believers in Christ, do you see a resurgence of any kind of faith in Europe? Because I lived in Berlin a number of years ago. It was already post-Christian. It really was. And that was many years ago. Do you see any kind of glimmer of light of the gospel in Europe right now?
I do. The short answer is I do. I mean, yes, it is a post-Christian culture, especially in Western Europe, as you know, from having lived there. But the further east you go, you know, when you get into Central and Eastern Europe, with the exception of the Czech Republic, for unique historic reasons, the Roman Catholic Church, which had been dominant there, has really lost all of its, you know, social and cultural authority. But Czech Republic, you know, aside, most of the rest, if not all the rest of Central and Eastern Europe, has much greater portion of the population that is devout, that takes their faith seriously, whether that be Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, with a few Protestants thrown in for good measure, but it's overwhelmingly either Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox in each of those countries. And most of them, a great percentage of those populations, take their faith seriously. Now, even in Western Europe, which you're right, is post-Christian, because the dominant governing elites have forced that on them, and have somehow convinced them that Christianity was at least a big part of the reason for the sins of Europe in the past, European, you know, colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a whole other discussion. However, European, Western European society has become post-Christian. It has rejected the tenets of Christianity, which, in my view, and I know you share that view, has, you know, were the theological tenets that made democratic governance, that made free markets, that made human rights, and a belief that we're all equal before the law because we are all of equal value before our Creator. That was all made possible by these Judeo-Christian tenets, as you know. And so, yes, the elites have rejected that, and much of the population has, because they've had many generations of brainwashing in their education system and another in the media and other areas. However, to answer your question, there is always a remnant. When you go through Christian history, you'll see that when the church appeared to be down and out, and by the church, I don't mean a formal church such as the Roman Catholic Church, for example, or any other kind of church. I just mean the universal church writ large, Protestant, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, whatever it is, all who are followers of Christ, that church. There does seem to be a growth of Christian faith in each of these Western European countries that I have seen, partly because of the vacuousness, the spiritual vacuum that has been left, and the unsatisfactory way that that a materialist philosophy, which is really what dominates in Western Europe, it doesn't satisfy the soul at the end of the day. So you have a lot of people in Western Europe that are realizing that there's this vacuousness there. This is vacuum that isn't meeting their spiritual needs, their God-shaped hole in their heart, as we would see it. And so I do see this as an opportunity if the church as a whole can get its act together, can spread the message of what the gospel truly is in a way that makes people finally in Western Europe say, oh, I didn't know that that's what Christianity was. I thought Christianity was racism, homophobia, you know, all the things that we're accused of. I didn't know that it was about setting our spirit free, that it was about, you know, a countercultural lifestyle, sacrificing for others. All the things that you and I know Christianity is about. It's about the road not taken, right? It's a very sacrificial life, and one that it's not an easy road, and it's certainly not about racism, imperialism, and, you know, all the other things they claim it's about. I see a growing ability in Western Europe of some Christian groups to be able to communicate that, and I think there's a real need there, a spiritual need on the part of the Western European people that is not clearly being met by the materialistic philosophy that guides them right now. And so I am optimistic that there will be a resurgence of Christian faith. How long that will take, I don't know. But I'm hopeful that it will be quick enough where it can have an impact on Europe also economically and politically.
Yeah. Well, isn't it interesting? Because you're an expert on global politics. I'm a layperson and been covering it for years. But we, as Christians, we see God's hand in all of this. And we know that things will come, nations will go and rise and fall, and that God is in it all. And it's just interesting to see the interplay. And it's an exciting time to be alive with the good and the bad. Well, Dr. Paul Coyer, if people wanted to stay in touch with you, if they did, or if you wanted them to, how could they do that?
If somebody hears this and wants to reach out to me, they could do so by my email address. I'm okay giving that out. That is historian, HISTORIAN, at hush.com.
Okay.
And then they might want to put something in the subject line that indicates that they're a listener of Sandy Rios.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll definitely go into my spam folder, and I'll never see it. So they might
All
want
right.
to do something like that.
All right, historian at hush.com if you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Paul Coyer. Paul, thanks a lot. Where's your next adventure?
Romania.
Oh, man. All right, we have to talk after that, too, then. All right, God bless you, Paul, and thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. God bless you, too. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. All right, Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. I don't know about you, but I love Scripture. I love it. I think it's the source of our strength in good times and in bad. It recalibrates our thinking and inspires us, encourages us, and it's life-giving. There's life in those words. And so with that in mind, I want to read to you Isaiah 44:3. It says, "For I will pour water on him who is thirsty, and floods on the dry ground. I will pour my spirit on your descendants, and my blessing on your offspring." This is the theme for this year's Share-a-thon. And American Family Radio, of course, has a Share-a-thon every fall and in spring. And I really miss doing the campaign as I used to do on the radio, where we really emphasized what American Family Radio was doing. We talked about the hosts, their ministry, their vision for what they're doing, all the different ministries. American Family Association has done such great work through the years. In fact, the founder, Don Wildman, was a coworker with me when I was in Washington, D.C. We became friends and we caused some trouble together. It was kind of fun and serious at the same time. But now American Family Association is headed by Tim Wildman, who is his son, and Walker Wildman, who is his grandson. And they're both doing a great job. But of course, they can't do what they're doing. And that means bringing truth through the lens of Scripture, through the lens of God's Word. They can't keep doing that without your help. And every year that there's been a share-a-thon that I've been a part of, there's no begging that has to take place because the listeners of American Family Radio give generously. Now, why am I talking about this today? Because my podcast, Sandy Rios 24/7, is still part of the American Family Radio family. American Family Radio makes it possible for me to do it. They help financially. They provide, you know, Adam is my engineer. And so the equipment that I use is their equipment, and they support me 100%, which I'm so grateful for. It makes it possible for me to bring you information every day. And, of course, there are so many great hosts on American Family Radio. If you're listening to the podcast and you've never listened to American Family Radio, go to AFR.net, and you can find the stations around the country, maybe some that are near you. One unique thing about American Family Radio is they're listener-supported. If you would like to support them, and that means you're supporting my podcast and all of the radio shows, that the fine radio programs that they put out. I was just on with Dr. Nurse Mama last week. Dr. Nurse Mama is hosted by Dr. Jessica Peck. She's a pediatric nurse practitioner, a professor, an author, and a mom. She gives great advice. What a great program. I commend that to you. But there are other great programs about that are political. Hers is more about, you know, raising children and some other things like that. Just a ton of wisdom, and I really enjoyed that. But there's great programming on just about any topic that you would like to hear about and information that you can trust. If you would like to help American Family Radio thrive and move on to greater heights, you can pledge some money at 1-877-616-2396. That's 877-616-2396, or go to AFR.net. AFR.net if you'd like to do it online. Most of you are, many of you are part of our American Family Radio family already, but if you're not and this is new to you, then you might want to check it out and you might want to help them. It's 877-616-2396 or AFR.net to give online. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
When you become a monthly sponsor of Preborn, you will actually get a picture of the babies you help to save. That's pretty good plum, isn't it? But also, you can sponsor what's called a Day of Life. And that's sponsoring an entire day of women, you know, having ultrasounds at these clinics. And it's more money. It's a bigger investment. For a gift of $5,000, you can sponsor an entire day. And so that's why we call it a Day of Life. If you'd like to do that, if you can afford to do that, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
All right, so that's our French friends across the pond, you know, fighting for Marie Le Pen, expressing their outrage that she should get 4 years in prison and be banned from running for office for 5 years. It is completely despicable what the French, but what the EU and the courts there have done. So it's happening around the globe, as we discussed. We just actually slapped it down in this country, but who knows how long? This is a move to kind of have control. And when you ask about where it comes from, I think that move comes from the pit of hell. It comes from the pit of hell. We all know scripture, and we know that there's going to be an end, and there's going to be, like, for instance, a European, it sounds like from the description of the land masses, it will be a European Union of sorts. And so these things all comport and fit in really the notion of what God says in his word. It just affirms our faith and gives us hope, because we know that no matter how bad it gets and how successful the forces, the dark forces who want to overtake and destroy various countries, destroy Christianity, take away free speech, no matter, institute transgenderism, all kinds of things that are just completely anti-Christian and appalling to those of us who name the name of Jesus, that this is going to come to an end someday. And so we're just watching it. We're watching the thing unfold. And so what's happening in the world is nothing that God does not know about. Does that mean we shouldn't fight back? Absolutely not. Jeremiah fought in his time, rebuking the king, speaking the truth, and trying to fight for his country. You know, you can't separate in the Old Testament the religious leaders, the Jewish leaders, from the government, because it was all the same. So we get confused sometimes thinking, I think, that our pastors and our leaders and those of us as Christians should not be involved in our earthly affairs. But the prophets show us that that's just not true. It's just not true. We have to take a stand on what's right, and we have to speak what's true, because being a prophet means to not only to foretell, but to tell forth. Well, all right, the whole earth is groaning right now in expectation of the coming of the Lord Jesus. But that gives you kind of a panoply, kind of an idea of what's happening around the globe in preparation for that. Well, before we say goodbye today, I want to thank our sponsor, Timothy Plan, because they help us learn how to put our money where our values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.